Welcome to the Recovering Nice Guy Podcast. This is the place for nice guys who are ready to kick the habit of people-pleasing and ditch those self-sabotaging behaviors for good. Now, here's your host, me, Chuck Chapman. Orgasm and meditation, two of my favorite things. Put them together and what do you got? A mind-blowing practice called, oddly enough, orgasmic meditation. And my guest today on the Recovering Nice Guy is here to shed some light on this intriguing technique. His name is Mark Wint, and he's a coach who specializes in working with men and has a fascinating story to tell. He shares his journey of self-discovery, which began after his marriage and career in the film industry ended. Mark delves into how orgasmic meditation transformed his relationships and emotional intelligence. He also discusses the challenges that he's faced, including struggling with weight and emotional eating, and how self-awareness and discipline have been the keys to maintaining a healthy lifestyle. Throughout our conversation, Mark offers insights into vulnerability, effective leadership, and the neuroscience of manifestation. So join me and Mark as we uncover the powerful steps to lean into your full potential. Here's how my conversation with Mark went. Guys, I'm excited today to give to you a gift. And the gift is in the form of this man, Mark Wint. Mark is going to come on today and talk to us about some of the things that he struggled in life. We're just going to have a conversation. So I just wanted to welcome you, Mark. Thanks for coming on the podcast. So
thank you, Chuck. It's good to be here. And it's good to know what you're doing with men's work.
Yeah, you too. And I love your passion around working with men and coaching men, and that that's a real focus for you. What got you into this work?
So about 2014, my marriage was ending, and my amazing career in the film business was also ending at the same time. And I was looking for something that was going to provide me with insight into why my marriage fell apart. And I was coming at that from this position of radical responsibility. Like, what did I do? How did I co-create this outcome? Because I want to make sure that the things that had me operating that way are things that I work within and neutralize so that I can create a much more fulfilling life. And as I was doing that, I got involved with a number of interesting sorts of avenues to that, not the least of which was this practice of orgasmic meditation and a group called One Taste. But that was a powerful experience, but more powerful than that was a man named Ken Blackman, who had left that group by that point in time. And Ken was running something called the Razor's Edge New Masculine Program. And in that process, I discovered aspects of myself that I wanted to shift into a more powerful energetic frequency. And as a result of that, and being in the sessions with him and the workshops with him, I had a flashback to when I was 10 years old and my parents were leading group therapy sessions, and they would have workshops, and the parents would park their kids in daycare. And my parents had me teaching the same ideas to the kids that my parents were teaching, which was all based on Eric Fromm's work, a book called The I'm Okay, You're Okay, which is an early 70s version of emotional intelligence.
Transactional analysis?
Transactional analysis.
Yeah.
And while I was in these groups transforming myself, I started to remember how powerful I can be in terms of relating to men. And I would ask really potent, almost coaching questions. And at one point, I actually got a caution from one of the leaders, like, hey, Mark, like, we want you to participate. Don't try to lead. And I thought that was really potent advice because I had shit to do. Can I say that word?
Sure.
On your podcast? Yeah. Okay, great. But what sparked me at that point was this idea of that I have this capacity that was underdeveloped. And the following year, Ken offered a year-long coaches training called the Coaching Dojo. And he and another person, a woman named Alexandra, she and he developed a coaches training method. And I graduated that after a year. And I was still working part-time. I had moved into another career avenue out of the film business. It was really, I was an archivist and audiovisual professional. And so I was working for the local union doing events and then also working for a company called the Internet Archive. Most people know that as the Wayback Machine.
Yeah. Okay.
And I was dealing with physical storage and working through my issues. I learned how to have way better relationships through my masculine development. And I wasn't going to be in the warehouse archiving business a lot longer because I'm at that time I was 57 and I was really not interested in being, you know, in a physically demanding job much longer. And so I began to train in earnest and I took another, it was called the Men's Wisdom Work Coaching Certification. And then I did another deep dive at something called the Remember Institute, which is all about unpacking various aspects of diversity, inclusion, and equity. And that set me up with a mindset that had me at a position to be of service. And so I started a coaching practice in, you know, on the weekends and at nights, and it was a fledgling coaching practice. But in 2018, I went full time and I was able to transition into the full time of being a coach. And recently, in order to keep my edge, you know, I keep studying and I keep, and recently I've been involved with something called the All In CEO program, which has been, you know, doing initiations. And I was part of a mastermind there. And so I'm just constantly on the development edge, but I'm also able to, I identified that the thing that would give me purpose and vibrance when I get up in the morning was being of service. Yeah. And that was a big transition.
Sounds like we're cut from the same cloth. Maybe listening to you, I'm like, yeah, this is my background too. You know, I worked, for 15 years in advertising and marketing, had a, you know, crisis of faith and humanity and, pretty much lost everything. And then, had to figure out how to find my way back. So I think I love that story of what you just shared with us, because I think it's so important, because I think so many men, it can parallel with this, right? Where we're just going on along in life and we're just trying to do the thing that we can do to make money and have a family and just survive. And then something train wreck happens. And then it's at that point, you know, call it a midlife crisis, call it whatever you want. But it's at that point that's transitional for us to start. Either we're going to go back and do what we've always done, or we're going to figure out what we've been doing wrong and find out how to do it differently. So I love that.
Yeah, it calls us into a level of warriorship in our life that by circumstance.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The invitation for anyone who's listening is not to wait for the crisis to occur. Yeah. The invitation is to stand up right now and take on a new level of powerful exploration of your abilities and areas where a challenge could help you develop so that you don't have to go through the collapse of the house of cards, or you can just start, you know, building now.
Right.
And that's what I find interestingly in a lot of my client development is a lot of guys won't enter into the space of personal development until they're up against a divorce or until they're up against an employment challenge. And my wish for men was it would be that they would seek out brotherhood and men's work as a function of a balanced life. Particularly around emotional processing. Like so much of my life was trying to process with my woman. And that did not go well, as you can imagine. And once I developed a brotherhood of men and I could do that work and be vulnerable with men and get feedback and get razor sharp, you know, challenge, suddenly I could be in a vulnerable place in my relationships that didn't threaten the safety of my partner, that had my partner feel, you know, powerfully connected as opposed to, you know, averse to how deep my different challenges run.
Right. Yeah. I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, because I'm sure everyone, including myself, our ears perked up when you said orgasmic meditation. Was that what you said?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because that.
So that's a 15-minute practice that involves a stroker and a woman. And typically it's a man and a woman, but it's not essential.
Okay.
And that practice came out of some work that was done by a group called The Warehouse. And one of the members of that was a woman named Nicole Dedone. And she wrote a book called Slow Sex. And then she and Ken Blackman started this organization called One Taste. And there's been a documentary on Netflix about One Taste. And you know, there were some definitely some issues with the way that organization developed around a profit center.
Sure.
But Ken's development and Nicole's development of the core practice of orgasmic meditation had immense value for me in terms of relationship. And the practice is pretty explicit. So if there's any children around and there's a speaker, you probably want to arrange for them to not hear what I'm about to say. But orgasmic meditation is where a woman lays down naked from the waist down in what's called a nest. And then a stroker, in my case, a man, me, sits next to her in a posture that allows him to stroke her clitoris directly for 15 minutes. Now, it's called orgasmic meditation, but there's no goal. So as a man, sitting down in that situation and confronting my desire to make something happen was really challenging. And it taught me how to be in what's called attunement with what was happening with the woman's body that I was involved with. And it's really potent because I can feel what's happening for her in the tip of my finger. And I can sense needs like a change of pace, a change of pressure. I can also make offers and she can make requests. The practice itself has a very specific framework. It's only 15 minutes long. You don't offer sex when you're done.
Okay.
There's a kind of, you know, Japanese tea ceremony aspect to it that has you drop into a very meditative state of connection. And it was confronting because I had to meet all of my desire to be a good stroker. And that translated to sex. Like all of the things that I was in my sexual relationships where I was like, oh, I want to, you know, make her orgasm, or I want to, you know, show up as a powerful man who knows what he's doing. Having a 15-minute orgasmic meditation practice gave me access to a way of being that didn't have all of that weighty expectation in it. And I could just be present in each breath. With each sensation that arose for her, but also in me, it gave me access to something called an emotional sensing frame, which is where part of the practice is that at the end, you share part of the experience with your partner. And you say, at this moment when this occurred, I had this emotion and this sensation in my body. I've brought that into my coaching practice as a core foundation of emotional intelligence, because we're navigating reality through our emotions and our sensations at a high level, but most men are not trained to do anything with that information. And so now I've got a really clear awareness of what that information is useful for and how to apply it in skillful communication in my relationships, both professional and in my intimate romantic relationships.
That's so good. I think it really speaks to I think some of the things that nice guys struggle with, you know, which is, I want to make sure she's happy, you know, happy wife, happy life. So that even includes like in the sexual realm, and focusing so much on the performance piece of it and really kind of get into the meditative piece and the connection with that. I would think that would be really profound for both people in that experience, and probably reduce a lot of shame. Before all of this, did you struggle with sexual shame? And was that?
I was raised in the free love era. And, I had kind of the opposite. I had, a kind of high level performative expectation of myself. And, I've always been blessed with a high testosterone and a high functioning erection. So I didn't really grapple with that shame much. But I understand it from the point of view of wanting to be a person who is safe in relationship by being a pleaser. Right. You know, one of the things I did while I was doing my men's work was read No More Mr. Nice Guy. And there was a lot of me in that. And so, you know, as I said to you in the preamble, I have the 30 things as flashcards here, and I program myself pretty much every day as part of my morning ritual with that information. So, you know, I have a broad range of experience, and I am a recovering nice guy for sure.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So tell me a little bit more about your practice in terms of how do you take a guy where he's at? And I know you do a lot of coaching with executives. Take a guy from point A to point B. What's your process?
Well, I don't have a cookie cutter approach because men are diverse and they have so many different ranges. But one of the continuums or potential continuums that I work on is this idea of polarity between stoic unavailability and being a sensitive new age kind of noodly wimpy guy.
Okay.
And I also understand what people talk about as polarity theory, this idea of masculine feminine polarity.
Yep.
And so within that, I have identified a range of dynamic relating. And that means that we as people, male, female body, it doesn't matter. We have the feminine energies and the masculine energies available to us. So a man that might come to me to do some work might not have a lot of masculine strength or things like leadership and provision and protection and, you know, what's commonly referred to as a spine or whatever. So he's going to be towards one side of the continuum that's very sensitive and very emotionally driven. Or a man might come to me and he's, you know, very powerful in his work life and has a lot of achievements, but he doesn't know how to deal with his feelings or his emotional side. And he definitely doesn't know how to calibrate that in his relationship. So he's considered stoic, but that's kind of an inaccurate reflection of what the Stoics were like, because they actually had a deep emotional intelligence if you read through Marcus Aurelius and the various things. So I take men and I decode what their challenges are, where they aren't accessing certain aspects of their dynamic potential on that continuum. And then I help them identify the communication skills and then the embodiment principles that have them show up in discipline and practice and presence. And that leads to charisma, that leads to leadership, and that leads to, you know, communication skills that have, that are informed by emotional intelligence.
Cool. I like that. Let me ask you a little bit more in-depth question, right? What causes you pain? What part of your life was the most painful, and how did you survive that?
I think there's a lot of answers to that. I think if we look at root causes, I had a father who wasn't present to the family unit in the as a producer and a protector. And that made me defer to my mother's leadership a lot. My safety was sourced out of her safety. And so that challenge of being able to divest that habitual nature from myself and actually being safe and existing as someone who was powerful and safe and able to stabilize my own nervous system without someone else in the equation necessarily, that was a huge challenge. And, you know, that shadow still exists. And because I've made it my friend and I'm familiar with it and I don't deny it and I don't push it down, I have clear access to it in the moment. And before it can get really wild and out of control and spiral, I'm like, oh, there's that side of me again that just wants to safety through my partner's comfort. And I have a lot of strategy and a lot of discipline and practices that help me not fall into that hole anymore. But the deepest, most vulnerable, authentic thing I could share with you is that I struggle with my weight. I'm an emotional eater. And I've been through all kinds of different processes. I've lost weight. I've gained it back a bunch of times. It's pretty clearly, but in my men's group yesterday, I was talking about this and, you know, I was like all calories in, calories out. Like I had that whole masculine thing going and, and my teacher, my mentor said, well, actually it's, what about the emotion, Mark? What are the emotions behind the eating? And that was very uncomfortable, but it was also a gateway to me being really in touch with what's happening when I'm trying to put food that doesn't have function in my mouth. And so, you know, as a practice of a man who shows up in men's spaces and public spaces with authentic vulnerability, but also powerful, you know, spine, I'm totally willing to say that and, you know, be open about that challenge.
Definitely something I've struggled with too, as well. You know, the ups and downs of it. Sometimes I'm doing really great and sometimes I'm not, you know, and I think that the body is both a wonderful thing, a wonderful tool, but it's also the cravings that we have that are just kind of these natural cravings for, you know, sweets and fats and carbs and all of that. So it can be a real difficult challenge to have that, but then also grapple with the emotional side of it. You know, like I've been in the last couple months, I've been doing stellar. You know, I haven't been eating any processed foods. I've only been eating, basically proteins, meat and vegetables. And I feel so much better doing that. And then last Friday night, my wife and I went out on a date and we stopped at a store and those damn Girl Scouts were sitting there. And my wife was like, oh, let's get some Girl Scout cookies. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, what kind should we get? And my favorites are the chocolate peanut butter. So I said, let's get those. And with all intent and purpose, I was going to have one. And it ended up being one box, you know? So I can definitely relate to that. And I just had to, and then like the next day, I'm like rooting around the house looking for chocolate and peanut butter. And then I just kind of dawned on me, like I'm just in this sort of addict mentality at this point, and had to, you know, really start to do the inner work again around the eating. It was emotional, but it was also just like driven by the sugar. I also recognized like how crappy I felt, like in the evening, like just lethargic and slow. And it was such a familiar feeling too. And so those kind of things helped me get back on track. So, you know, the Girl Scout cookies are gone now and I'm back in the habit.
You ate them all up.
But it's a war. It's a war, right? It's where a warrior, part of that internal warrior has to come in and play and be like, nope, this is what we got here. So,
yeah. And I coach from the standpoint of being seen. Like I don't try to present this perfect image because I think there's so much more to be gained from this idea of we're all on a journey and we're all practicing. And I don't like to create division or superiority. In fact, the idea that superiority and inferiority exist, I think is a misnomer. It's really just about creating the kinds of actions and the kind of emotional landscape that you want and leading your life that way. And I choose that word specifically, leading your life a specific way. And, you know, I'm like you, if I eat anything that's not in my, you know, healthy diet profile, I feel it right away in my morning practices, you know, my Qigong and my meditation is stiffer. I don't feel as fluid and I'm not up for that. So it's really more about quantity for me as opposed to quality. Like I'm pretty good with the various things, sugars and things like that. And I just had a birthday 2 weeks ago and there was cake.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
When was your birthday?
March 7th.
Okay. Well, March 11th. So.
Oh, wonderful. Fabulous. So it's a couple of Pisces wearing black shirts in this show.
Gee, go figure.
Welcome to the Pisces black shirt party here. So that's the big challenge. And I turned to my men, yesterday and I got good counsel and I don't feel disempowered. I don't feel guilt or shame about this. I'm connected to how I have to move. Mm. And, you know, back in September, I lost 15 pounds in 6 weeks as part of a 21-day challenge that I participated in. And I had some injuries that occurred as a result of that. We were reading David Goggins' book, and I was going hard.
Yeah.
And I just went a little too hard for my age group. And so now I've been, you know, nurturing an injury that's now starting to, I'm getting more function. My physical therapy is working. So now I'm going to be able to do the things that help me manage my weight better, which is cycling and walking. Yeah. And so consistency is the name of the game, and that's what I practice. And so instead of 3 mile walks every day, I've been doing mile and a half at 48 hour intervals, which has allowed me enough recovery time. I'm 61, so my muscular recovery time is slower. And I needed a doctor and I needed a physical therapist and a trainer to say, like, Mark, you can't just go hard. That's not the answer. Go smart.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, if I got 15 off in 6 weeks, I know I'm going to be, you know, down to my fighting weight, as it were, very soon. And I'm not worried. I'm not self-judging. I'm not anxious. I'm just on it, you know, counting those macros.
Yeah. Well, you said something that, you know, about the idea of superiority and inferiority. And I think that's really key. I know that in my coaching practice, like I coach around what I call virtues. And one of the virtues that I have, personal virtue, would be humility. And humility is that ability to see myself not better than, not worse than, not even equal to, but sort of at the same time, separate from and responsible for me personally. And so I coach from a standpoint as well, like just vulnerability. Like I'm an open book, so to speak. And I can really relate to that. And I think probably the people that you coach can feel that as well.
Yeah. I think there's a distinction we can make around vulnerability. And I think that in the conversation that men are having around this issue, vulnerability is a pathway to awareness internally and then also to transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a trigger word for some people because, you know, vulnerability implies weakness on some levels. Right. And if you live in vulnerability, you can quickly fall into powerlessness because it's not necessarily an end or a means. It has to be part of an action plan. Mm-hmm. And it has to be calibrated, and your communications around what your vulnerability are have to be done skillfully.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to feel the thing and share it in good counsel. And to me, that's my men.
Yeah.
I don't share this stuff with my female partner.
Right.
Right. Unless there's a moment where it's really attuned to say, right now I'm feeling filled in the emotion. And I'm not afraid, and we have full permission, and it's part of our relationship agreement to have that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also something I don't wade into, you know, as a means to all of the relationship dynamics. What I find is that she feels more unsafe when there's too much of that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my ethos around vulnerability. It's like, it's really about transparency and access to my state of being, and then moving my state of being in the recognition that, oh, it's powerful for me to know what I'm experiencing before I try to shift it, because the shift it game can always be a mask. You can go like to, I'm supposed to be strong and masculine, and then you're in denial and you've just covered something over. You actually have to allow it to fully move through the somatic experience before you can shift it.
But
you know, it's discovering my own path to vulnerable awareness of my emotional state was one of the key things that shifted my capacity as a man, and then learning to harness that in ways that were effective. And it's funny because you wouldn't think that executive coaching would be so much about emotional intelligence, but it turns out that that's the key.
Yeah.
The key is motivation through inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, consequence-based motivation, even pay scale. You know, we all want better pay, but at the end of the day, pay scale isn't proven to drive the kinds of productivity you need from your team. Mm-hmm. It's really inspiration that drives that. And that's something I call professional intimacy. When you have enough of an emotional bond that is properly calibrated to the workplace,
mm-hmm.
your boundaries, you know, it operates at a level of, you know, business, but it's inspiring when there's enough candor and enough, conversations that can include authentic, transparent realities. Say you got a sales team that isn't tracking against their quarterly results. You want the kind of transparency and accountability and then authenticity where they can come to you and say, look, we're not, our KPIs aren't tracking at this level. What can I do? Right. Mm-hmm. Because they trust and they're inspired by their leadership to be able to deliver some kind of actionable steps that are not just, well, try harder or make more calls or, you know, that kind of insight doesn't necessarily move the needle.
Yeah.
And so, there's this crossover between executive coaching that's kind of encapsulated in my catchphrase, and I'll just throw it out there. Happy homes make productive C-suites. And it turns out that if you're willing to do the work to learn to be emotionally intelligent and have high-level communication skills, you can lead your household in a way that creates the safety and intimacy that you crave and that your partners crave and your children crave. And you can lead your teams effectively towards the results that the company needs.
Absolutely. Yeah, because as a leader, you're setting the tone for the culture, whether it's your culture at home, the culture, you know, in the office. But if you're not consciously setting that tone, you know, and I like to say, my intention at home and the office of my clients is to always create a culture of gratitude and appreciation, because I think that as humans, when I feel safe and when I feel important, then I'm going to feel connected. And when those three needs are met, you know, whether it's at home, whether it's in the office, you know, where I feel like I matter, I feel like I'm important, I'm not worried about, you know, losing my job or something along those lines, then I'm going to feel more connected. And the more connected I feel, the more I'm going to be able to produce. And essentially what I usually generally refer to as like the energetic love that we put out. So whether that's you're putting that out in the office, or putting it out at home, that everything we do comes back to transmuting love to others. And I think by doing that, what happens then is you increase the inspiration. The inspiration then creates the productivity.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Yeah. And there's a form of fierce warriorship that's love,
mm-hmm.
that's committed to challenge and overcoming mm-hmm. challenge in a way that is conscious, compassionate, and devoted to the outcome. It's not all the soft, sort of mushy love, right?
Right.
And I'm loving that I'm challengeable because I'm no longer fear my own collapse in the face of challenge. And I think that's a really important type of warriorship to develop for people. Mm-hmm. And there's so much to be gained by men standing up in our culture right now.
Yeah.
And people are looking for that from us. They're looking for us to lead from a new iteration on what leadership means. Mm-hmm. It's not the old, you know, 50s, 60s, what data would recall of stage one or even stage two at this point. So we have this opportunity to set the tone for ourselves mm-hmm. because we're loving warriors devoted to change and overcoming challenges on behalf of our communities, on behalf of our constituencies, our loved ones, and our brotherhood.
So much so. Absolutely. What are your practices? I mean, the rituals, what kind of things do you do on a regular basis, daily basis to get yourself in this state.
Yeah. So before my injury, it also included a 3-mile walk. Uh-huh. But like I said earlier, that's shifted. But my daily routine involves waking up and winning the morning, which means 5:30. Mm-hmm. And I'm in this space. You might see behind me some candelabras. There's a whole altar behind me. And so I have a Qigong and a meditation practice that starts my day. And then as a part of the end of the meditation practice, I have a series of affirmations that I've designed from a program that I run called the Neuroscience of Manifestation. Mm. And then once I've done those, I do different journaling exercises depending on what's running for me. Mm-hmm. The idea being that the mind is active while we sleep and it creates a sense of vigilance. And first mm-hmm. thing in the morning, I want to attune that energy to the most productive and, you know, creative force as opposed to fear-based reactivity. And so I start with the body and the breath. Qigong and meditation are embodiment practices. And then I'm codifying my conscious awareness of who I am, who I'm choosing to become through the affirmation process. And my affirmations are built around kinesthetic anchors. It's not just I am this, mm-hmm. it's I see, smell, taste, feel emotions. So when you anchor that stuff to a deeper layer of the body, you get another layer of resonance in mm-hmm. your nervous system. And then after journaling, I have a shake, you know, and then I'm doing my, you know, social media. I'm focused on LinkedIn right now, but it's still basically creating community is the ultimate mm-hmm. practice. So I enter into that work from this place of attunement, of really crystallizing the kind of conscious awareness I want to bring to my communication. Mm-hmm. And then it's clients and client development. And then other, you know, I have other activities that I'm involved in. I'm a screenwriter and a musician. And, and I have a podcast as well. Mm-hmm. It's not attuned to men's work. It's a kind of different flavor.
Right. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the neurobiology of manifestation.
The neuroscience of manifestation.
Neuroscience. Yeah.
Yeah. So manifestation has a spiritual component that a lot of people understand, which is this idea of resonance, about creating a vibration in the world mm-hmm. that people can, that then gets matched by the universe. So you kind of create a desire matrix and you resonate with it and then you create abundance. It's, you know, it's, that's the theory from the spiritual side of things. And it works. I think there's some physics that go with mm-hmm. that. And Joe Dispenza's talked about that. You've read his work, there's a lot there. I started to come into awareness of these different neuroscientists, and I discovered three different guys, Anil Seth from Britain, a guy named Blaine Ulkers, who gave a really interesting TED talk, and then I just mentioned him, but now I'm having a senior moment. Anyway. Those three guys talk about a bunch of different things, one of which is the RAS, the reticular activating system, which is a part of the brain that selects and filters what our awareness comes to. So if you've ever been in the market for a red car,
right? Yeah.
Then everywhere you see, there's the red car, and that's mm-hmm. your brain attuning to your desires, right? And then the work of Anil Seth in Sussex University, he talked about something called predictive perception, which is the idea that our brains actually create our experience, not just observe mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And he's done a lot of neuroscience research, and there's an amazing TED talk he gave where he talks about this in depth, and I think it's from 2017.
Okay.
And then Joe Dispenza, that's the third one.
Yeah.
He's talked about how you attune yourself mentally and physically. Right. And so when you tie your thoughts to a set of outcomes and they have a kinesthetic anchoring in your emotions and your sensations, and then you repeat that, you reprogram the reticular activating system to recognize mm-hmm. patterns like that. Yeah. You also create a vibration in your body that's resonant in the quantum field, according to Dispenza. And so the practice of a new neurological workout is not just a practice of affirmations, but it's a practice of really embodying the emotions and the sensations and the ideas, right? Head, heart, and balls, all of it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're moving through the world at that resonance. You're literally vibing like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not coming from an abstract spiritual concept. It's coming from an actual neurological workout that you do, that you cultivate on a daily basis. I'm priming myself with the Qigong and the meditation to receive the affirmations. And then those are carefully crafted. Every year I do this ritual where I take last year's and I refine them and I connect to new desires. And then I take actions that are in alignment with that. And that's where the reticular activating system is so potent, because what happens is stuff pops up in my awareness that's actually in synergy with the things I'm cultivating, but I have to take actions to move towards them and cultivate them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not just a spiritual practice, which is that the spiritual practice is valid.
Right.
But it's a ritual, it's a ceremonial cultivation. And so neurology and the nervous system are a central core to that, along with the physical body, your musculature and skeletal.
Yeah, that's great. That's fascinating. I love neuroscience, and I'm a big nerd when it comes to, you know, the brain and how the brain works and, you know, all of that. So
I can. Yeah. So I do a 3-hour workshop with men about that particular process. And when they're done, they get that, the set of affirmations that they can do on a daily basis. And sometimes I use that in my coaching practice, depending on who I'm working with and what they're trying to achieve. And sometimes it's more appropriate to work with the sort of the day-to-day challenge analysis, discipline kind of journaling framework.
So speaking of that, how do people get involved with you? How can somebody connect with you, whether it's neuroscience of manifestation or your coaching or other programs that you have?
Well, if you're listening to this, you can just call me right now at 415-328-7668. 415-328-7668. Just call me, text me, or you can go to my website, Mark Wendt Coaching, markwendtcoaching.com. And you can book a free introductory, you know, conversation with me there. I'm also on all the things, like the TikToks and the Twitters and the, or X and the Facebooks and the, but LinkedIn is where I'm really spending my time, energy, and attention right now.
Great. Yeah, I forgot that there was this thing called a telephone. You could just dial in and connect with somebody right there. You know, you don't have to actually go to Instagram to message somebody.
Well, it's funny because for a long time I was like sort of protective of my number. And then I realized, well, wait, the thing's freaking everywhere. Like finding my phone number now would be super easy. And I'm like, what, you know, I can turn it off. Like I can put it on airplane. Like there's no reason not to put that out there. And, you know, I prefer phone conversations myself because, you know, I'm a boomer. I was the last year of boomers.
Last year boomer.
And I think voice communication is a really great introductory method to connect with people. And so, yeah, call me.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Any last thing that you want to leave these guys with? A word of wisdom?
Yeah. Yeah. Take a deep breath right now as you're listening to what I'm about to say. The world is in a place of transition. We're facing something that is as yet unknown to us, its level of challenge. People can smell it. They can feel it. Men, step into your power now. Don't wait. We have work to do. And if you need help, you can talk to me. You can talk to Chuck. You can find your local chapter of any men's group. This is the work. The world needs us right now.
That is absolutely true, man. Appreciate that. Mark, thanks for hanging out with me for this time.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chuck, and it was good to connect with you.
You too. Guys, if you like this interview, be sure to like and subscribe. Also, I want to invite you to listen to one of my favorite interviews that I did with Travis Schreb. He's an executive coach and a teacher of masculine embodiment, and we talk about how to unlock your potential with the art of dying complete. I'll put a link up here, and if you're listening to this on your favorite podcast platform, be sure to leave a review. It helps the message get out to other men who might be desperate to hear about hope and potential. Thanks again for joining me today. You've been listening to the Nice Guy Recovery Podcast with your host, Chuck Chapman. If you're looking to take your Nice Guy Recovery deeper, be sure to check out www.chuckchapman.com to find out how you and I can squash your nice guy behaviors once and for all.